Welcome, beloved Gladys and Potties, to another program in this RN's summer season. A little later, the search for the identity of a very mysterious rose growing in the woods in the Venetian countryside. But first, I'm going to quote from Olivera Simic's book, Surviving the Peace, A Political Memoir. Surviving violence and war marks a person's life forever. You carry it with you wherever you go. Only the intensity changes. Sometimes it is overwhelming, and sometimes it's just there waiting in a familiar touch, smell or sound that turns your peace of mind upside down in a split second. You become oversensitive and sometimes expect too much from others. Yes, surviving a war with your life intact is clearly a great achievement, but so often the peace which follows war can be even worse. That was the experience of Olivera. Following the war in the former Yugoslavia, she found her country profoundly changed, her language no longer spoken, even her family hopelessly divided, not only by distance, but by politics. Under Tito's rule, ethnic divisions were suppressed, and discussion of grievances which flared during World War II were barely tolerated. Consequently, one of the world's most ethnically and religiously diverse countries did, however, maintain the peace, but only while Tito lasted. After Tito died, it took 12 years for war to unravel in 1992, and that lasted until 1999 and gave us, amongst so many horrors, that most appalling of euphemisms, ethnic cleansing. And today the region remains riven by ethnic tension and divisions. Dr. Olivera Simic is a human rights activist and academic who studied and worked in Eastern and Western Europe, the US and South America. Today she teaches international law and transitional justice at Griffith Law School in Brisbane. Her new book is called Surviving the Peace, a political memoir, and I began by asking Olivera what she remembered of Bosnia as a child.
My memories of Yugoslavia or former Yugoslavia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, where I grew up, are very fond memories. And, you know, I usually remember my childhood, my teenage years, my friendships, my parents. We were middle class. We had a pretty nice life, if I can say, as a majority, I think, of Yugoslav people back then. So my memories of that time, just before war, are really nice and good memories. We had a free education, free health care. We could go to, you know, have holidays, go to the sea and the coast, what I did with my parents for one month yearly. We would go to the Adriatic coast and enjoy our holidays, as I said, majority, because majority of Yugoslav people back then were middle class. I remember Yugoslavia as a very progressive country. We could watch, you know, Western movies. We could listen to ABBA and Boney M and Billy Idol. So my childhood and teenage years, and I'm saying that because I know that my friends who grew up in Czechoslovakia, what was back then, they could not really
they didn't enjoy the same privileges. Now, I'm glad you've said this, because people have to understand that are listening to what we're saying, that Yugoslavia was not a grim Eastern European communist country. It was very much its own country. And yet the capital, Sarajevo, is a place where you can still find Jewish synagogues, an Ottoman mosque, Catholic and Christian Orthodox churches. Misha Glenny writes that it was through Bosnia that East met West, Islam met Christianity, the Catholic eyes, the Orthodox. And Bosnia, of course, also divided the empires of Vienna and Constantinople.
Yes, I think it's in the Balkans, because of specific geographical position, there was always, we have been, you know, Yugoslavia has been in this position between East and West, and has been of interest to great powers, and that's sort of trouble, and I guess that may be a trouble in the future. That's why we have almost every 30 or 40 years of war day, because there are a lot of interests going on in this region.
I mentioned ethnic cleansing when I was introducing you, but of course there's also linguistic engineering. Let's talk about that. Your mother tongue is Serbo-Croatian, but this was split after the war, each ethnicity to their own language. What are you now meant to speak?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, Philip. Thanks for asking that. And I'm usually confused, and people ask me, which language do you speak? I often pause and not sure how to answer. And that's probably the simplest question in the world. You can ask somebody, which language do you speak? And I'm always minded that whatever I say, it's loaded with politics. So, you know, and it puts you in particular ethnic box, or it puts you in particular political position. So if I say Serbo-Croatian, what I say, that I speak Serbo-Croatian, that's basically language that's gone, that's dead, and that actually died when Yugoslavia was proclaimed dead in 1992. Because we started then to, we have now three official languages, and each ethnic group claim to have their own language. It's basically the essence of that. These new languages, Serbian, Croatian, and Bosnian, is the same language. It is Serbo-Croatian, but with different variations of Serbo-Croatian and with some invented new words.
How do you feel about having a Serbian identity imposed upon you?
I don't feel good. I don't think of myself as a Serb. I don't have that ethnic identity. I have very much gender identity. I think of myself as a woman, as a feminist, as a researcher, as academic. But of course, my parents are Serbs, but I don't have that ethnic identity. And I think the more people try to enforce that identity, the more I struggle and reject that identity. And that became a struggle with my father too, who really wants me to have that identity, and I back up and I don't want and I resist. So the more he pushes or people pushes it, the more I back up and I say, this is not my identity. I don't want to have that identity. I did not grow up with this identity ever. So this identity I acquired after the war, I had to acquire after the war, you know, I had to be boxed. So people, when they ask me, where are you from or which language do you speak, it's usually with this intention to put you somewhere, you know, to put you in these boxes.
Now, since the war, Bosnia has gone through multiple transitions. Once again, I quote from you, from war to peace, from single-party rule to pluralist democracy, from communist planned economy to liberal market economy, from international protectorate to independent country. Has it survived these transitions, Ollie?
No, I don't think so, and that's the trouble. I don't think any of these transitions are have been ended. Actually, they are still there, and we are still going through this transition, and I'm not really sure how long will take that we transit to from war to peace, because what usually people will now say in Bosnia, they will say that we still have a war, but with another means. So there are no shooting, there are no guns, but war is, you know, on another battlefield, and it's waging with arms and with hearts and with minds rather than...
Well, 50% of the people are still unemployed.
Yes.
Many of those who finish university are unemployed. Yes. Mind you, that's not unique, of course,
yeah,
to Bosnia.
Of course.
And on top of everything else, you've had disastrous floods this year, added disaster.
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, it really seems one disaster after another. And this latest floods that happened in May, I just recently been to Bosnia and actually came back 2 weeks ago. And I've met a lot of my friends who stayed without job due to floods. So on the top of 50% of unemployed people, I think we at least have 10 or 15% more, because floods just destroyed even the small businesses who employed people who then were feeding their families.
Let's talk about you. Now, the war in Bosnia ends in 95. The war in Kosovo continues till 1999. Mm. And when fighting broke out, your lifelong friends, Bosniaks and Croats, had to flee. You never saw them again. And your parents sent you to neighbouring Serbia, where they thought you would be safe. This separation must have been so terrible.
Yeah, it was very difficult for me back then, because I was only 19 years old, and that was basically the first separation from my parents. I have never been separated before 1992 from them, and so that was the first separation, it was basically violence and forced separation because I had to go. They were basically very afraid for my life. And they decided that I need to leave the city after I was about to be drafted in some sort of civilian protection or something like that. So once when I went to pick up the boots and uniform with my father, that was for them the clear sign that it's time to leave. So basically overnight they just put me on the bus and sent me to Serbia. And I found myself in a refugee accommodation from then on.
Now, let's be clear here. You were not of an ethnic minority forced to flee, but you had to watch others fleeing. And the scenes you describe are terrible. I'm thinking particularly of the Croatian military operation called Storm. Tell us about Storm.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Philip, about that. And it's interesting you ask about Storm, because this also anniversary from the Operation Storm, which actually started on August 4 in 1995, so 19 years ago. And what's interesting about Storm is that what happened in Storm is that a quarter of millions of Serbs were expelled from Croatia in 4 days. A couple of thousands of them were killed during that Operation Storm. No one was held responsible. So initially, two generals, Ante Gotovina and Markač, Ivan Markač, were prosecuted by the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia. But then later on, their sentences and judgments were squashed and they were released. And not only that, but they have been welcomed in Croatia and the capital of Zagreb as a heroes, as a national heroes. And they are perceived as a national heroes in Croatia. In the meantime, so what is going to happen today in Bosnia or Serbia and Croatia? And that's interesting. Today, Croatian government is going to celebrate Operation Storm, or the beginning of Operation Storm, on August 4 as a day of victory and national day and day of pride, day of nationhood, while at the same time in Serbia it's going to be the day for mourning for people who had to flee their homes.
Ollie, now that you're with us in Australia, you would be aware that there's an echo of that same paradox on Australia Day, which white people see as a moment of unalloyed joy. Yes. But of course the indigenous population don't see it through that prism at all.
Yeah. Yes, these divisions and interpretations of history, of course, are not something that is unique to Bosnia. And, of course, it's something that we see in Australia as well, between Aboriginal people and white Anglo-Saxon people each day. When we mark Australian Day on January 26, these divisions and these narratives come up. The same is happening in Yugoslavia and the other countries of the world. It's not something unique. But these divisions and different narrations of the same events are something that deeply divides societies and something that we cannot come to consensus about.
Well, Ollie, let's look at the way they divided your family, because you feel a responsibility in your academic work to talk about crimes committed by your own people. And so when you go home to visit your parents, your father is very upset by what you've written, as is your brother, a former Serbian soldier.
Yes, my whole family does not approve of my research and of what I'm doing, and they are not happy with my writing. And my father, a few years ago, he told me, and I write about that, I have a chapter about that in Surviving Peace, that I have to stop writing. And I think there is a mixture of shame and embarrassment because his daughter is doing something that I shouldn't do, something that he doesn't want me to do, because I dedicated my work and my moral, because I feel moral responsibility to talk about crimes committed by my own ethnic group.
You quote Hannah Arendt, who wrote about the importance of individualized responsibility and about guilt as an individual matter.
Yes, I think moral responsibility and individual is guilt and individual responsibility is very important. If we want to change anything, we need to accept accountability and responsibility. Of course, I cannot be guilty for something that that perpetrators of the crime committed. I cannot be guilty for horrendous crimes that were committed on the part of my ethnic group or ethnic group of my parents. But there is moral responsibility, and that calls each of us to talk about crimes committed in our neighborhoods, crimes committed in our name. And it's very important to individualize guilt. And I think one of the obstacles now in Bosnia is also collective guilt. If we continue to collectively blame one part and only one side for the war, we will, I think, never come to any sort of reconciliation.
This is LNL on RN Summer, and I'm talking to Olivera Simic about her book Surviving the Peace, A Political Memoir. You've worked at various international organisations, at UNICEF, for example, and between 2007 and 10, you lectured on gender and war in Sarajevo. How open were these younger students to the idea of reconciliation?
Look, Philip, I think I've just been to Bosnia and Serbia, and I actually taught intensive course in transitional justice in the Balkans in Belgrade. And I had a group of students coming from all around the world, and from Israel, from Palestine, from Kosovo, from Serbia, from Bosnia. And always in this course, it's a very challenging. We have always heated discussions, and people who have first-hand experiences with war, especially people who lost someone there, they are actually very angry if you try to, if you use buzzword reconciliation. A lot of people don't like this word because they feel that they need to reconcile war ended today, and there was international community talking about reconciliation tomorrow, and people were not ready. So now we can say, so even 20 years after war was ended, people still don't feel ready. And I was thinking for a long time that we need to wait at a generation of my father. So I was blaming generation of my father who voted for war, who were very much playing the politics back then. And I was praying my hopes in this younger generation. But now actually, when I see how the younger generation are actually or can be very poisoned by the stories of their parents, I'm not that hopeful, because some of them are very resistant and some of them are looking for revenge, and some of them just say, no, I don't want to reconcile, and I will reconcile on my terms and when I feel ready, or I won't reconcile ever because I just can't forgive what happened. So,
Molly, just to go back to another aspect of the family problems. Your mother has said that there's a danger they could be killed because of what you write. You write in English, but these things have a way of getting known, and you are concerned. You do feel fear that someone could hurt your parents or brother, or at least bully and ostracize them.
Yeah, to be honest, yes, I wouldn't be honest to say, no, I don't have any fear and any doubts. I have, and I always have concern that something may happen. But I guess I have been writing about these issues for quite some time now. And so far, they haven't had any direct threats, or not at least that I know about it. But I know that they absolutely don't feel comfortable about what am I doing. So I hope that, nothing will happen to them, and I hope that I'm not really putting them into risk. But I am conscious and I am aware that the work that I choose to do is not something that is light, it's not something that is approved, it's not something that's welcomed in the part of the Bosnia in which they live in. That it's pretty, if I may say, I can't say dangerous, but it's absolutely not welcomed, right?
I haven't got any time to tell you the story about the film I wanted to make in Yugoslavia and in Australia, but it did involve the most appalling conflicts between Yugoslav groups in this country, where quite a few were being trained in the Dandenong Rangers, would you believe, to go to Yugoslavia and kill Tito. You've witnessed the NATO bombing of Sarajevo, and for 78 days, during both night and day, cluster bombs, depleted uranium munitions were dropped. It killed almost 1,000 civilians and was classified by NATO as collateral damage.
So I guess you're thinking about NATO bombing in Serbia, right?
Yes.
You mentioned Sarajevo. That's why I was just a bit confused. So yes, and in Niš, in southern Serbia, I was there during the NATO bombing or so-called humanitarian intervention. And I Remember those days. I think that NATO bombing was one of the final drops in the layers of the trauma that I survived, and it actually had a very horrendous impact on my being and how.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's focus on what you have suffered. Let's look at the PTSD. You left to work at Human Rights Watch in Washington, a terrific organization, and heavens above, you're there. And you witness another catastrophe, the attacks of 9/11, which reignited your problems.
Yes. Yes. So when I went to the U.S. in 2001, that was actually the first time. It was second time going that I went abroad. And I thought, as my parents and we were all thrilled, we thought that I'm going to the U.S. It was very exciting to go to the Washington, D.C. to work with the Human Rights Watch, amazing international organization. And I was about to work as a legal fellow on trafficking in women by peacekeepers, another interesting story there, back then. But what happened just a couple of weeks into my staying in a residence in Washington, D.C., was 9/11, and I was about to go from Washington, D.C. to New York on that day. And I described these events in quite detail, some of my feelings during these couple of weeks after September 11 and my panic attacks and flashbacks. And flashbacks were actually related to the NATO bombing, 78 days of NATO bombing in Serbia, that I never had time to think about them and reflect on them. So September 11 brought up these events from 2 years ago in 1999, but also other layers of trauma that were there that I never picked up.
I understand that at this time you also had your first encounter with the rather Western notion of counselling.
Yes. So once my dear boss back then, Martina Vanderberg, she noticed that something is going on with me, and she knew my background, she knew where I'm coming from, and she had a lot of experience working with people who survived trauma, people who are coming from post-conflict societies. She tried to pursue me to have a counseling for the first time in my life. I didn't know what's counseling really back then, because mental health was one of the issues we never discussed really, or we didn't discuss in former Yugoslavia. It was people who had some sort of mental disorders or illnesses were very much ostracized as they are today. So I didn't know what does that involve, and you know, she explained me that they are going to fly over this best psychotherapist from New York who is going to treat the staff in Human Rights Watch because of September 11, and she just asked me to give a try and talk to this woman, and I really didn't want, and I resisted. I said, no, I can't do this. This is just something. I don't know what to talk to this woman. I said, look, it's 2001. War started in 1992. I survived so many things so far, and I didn't know how to engage in this conversation. I had no clue how that was supposed to look like, because I never had that. My counselors were my friends or my family, and we would resolve these issues, talk about traumas, and probably re-traumatize each other by telling each other stories of trauma, but we never talked to third person to talk about issues.
So you go to Costa Rica, where, let the record show, there was an earthquake. As I said to you off air, you are, really are a troublemaker. Mm. And it's here that that things get worse and worse for you. You read about the mass rape of Muslim women. And so finally, 12 years after, you have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. So, yes, that happened in 2004 while I was doing gender and peace building masters in beautiful Costa Rica in Ciudad Colón at UN University for Peace. And that was the first time I was so distanced from Bosnia, from Yugoslavia, from war. But then I found myself in the small library at that university, very closely looking at what happened in the war. So that's a paradox, you know. People would think that I am authority to talk about war in Bosnia. When I came to university, everyone was excited to have somebody, you know, live example of somebody who survived Bosnian war. But then they encounter somebody who was so confused, and as I was confused back then, and not ready to talk about war at all. And I was actually surprised that people have these expectations, and they think I know everything about war, and they would ask me to talk about war, and and I was absolutely not ready. And also I started to read because I never, before that, I was not really engaged that much with the scholarly work around war, around mass atrocities, around mass rapes, around ethnic cleansing and genocide. But then at that place and time, I had all this time in the world, I had this distance, and I just started to spend hours and hours, days and nights in the library and back home reading about this and writing. That's where I started to write. But that's where I started to experience extreme flashbacks and panic attacks that I couldn't recognize at the beginning.
Then you moved to Australia in 2011, and once again, troublemaker as that you are, you're in time for the Brisbane floods.
Yes, in yes, I was here in Brisbane during the floods, which, you know, I'm not going to compare the floods with my experiences, and I actually don't like to do these hierarchies of traumatic experience. I think it's very dangerous. But why floods were important for me were in the sense that they, again, triggered some of these past traumas, layers of my past memories and fears and anxieties and uncertainties, and also fears and anxieties with my parents, because they also went through a lot with us as their kids, with my brother who was in war, with me who was in refugee, and then, you know, survived all these various things. They were following my life. And it was very disturbing in many senses to go through these floods, but also to observe how people behave and to think about my life yet again through prism of all these events that happened to me before.
Ollie, let's try to end on a slightly optimistic note, because there's a postscript here to a possible Bosnian spring, because you saw during reports of demos this year against government corruption, unemployment, poverty, three boys joining the Serb, Croat and Bosnian flags, for example.
Yes, I end up my book with this sign of hope that another future is possible, that we still can live together, that we don't have such divisions in Bosnia anymore. And I would like to think that another future is possible, and I want to think, and that's my work is about thinking that we can somehow overcome some of these issues that divide us. And I know that there are a lot of people in former Yugoslavia, not only in Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, peace activists and civil societies that I do a lot of work with, that do really amazing and very important things that government don't do. And they are trying with their actions, with their lobbying, with their theater plays, with their street actions, with all sorts of campaigns. They try to challenge these dominant views and hatred and stereotypes about particular ethnic groups, and trying to overcome and educate especially young people, put hope in young people that another future is really possible in Bosnia.
Olivera Simic talking to me in August this year. Her book, Surviving the Peace, a political memoir, published by Spinifex Press. This is Late Night Live on RN Summer, and coming up, the search for that mysterious rose. The last time I spoke to Italian journalist and author Andrea de Robiland, he was searching for the truth about the Venetian explorers, the wonderfully named Zen Brothers. Since then, Andrea has been on another search, this time for the identity of a rose growing in the woods in the Venetian countryside. Along the way, he encountered many rosophiles, both from the far distant past and the present, and it's safe to say he's developed a deep love of old roses. He wrote about this in his book, Chasing the Rose. And when he joined me on Skype from his home in Rome, I asked him to tell us a bit about this rose and what makes it so damn special.
Well, it's special to me because of various reasons that I hope we'll be able to talk to. But it's a very simple, very special rose, a Chinese rose of very old ancestry. and it's very beautiful and incredibly fragrant, and flowers all year round, and it's sort of silvery pink, and it's just a very beautiful and very generous rose, and
is it a climber, or just a, you know, do we tend to come upon it as a freestanding plant?
It's what they call a shrub. In other words, it's a sort of a small bush. Yeah.
Okay. I can almost smell it as you talk about it with such affection.
Well, it has a wonderful fragrance. It's sort of lemony and raspberry and all sorts of.
I'll stop things. It. You're getting me wildly excited. Now, it was after reading, and I've got to get all these greats right. Your great, 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 great grandmother's diary. That you realise that this rose must have been brought back from Paris, and this is where I can reintroduce Josephine Bonaparte. Tell us about the link between your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother and Mrs. Bonaparte.
Well, I'll tell you about my great-great-great-grandmother, Lucia, but before I have to tell you how I found the rose. In other words, I went on a sort of nostalgic pilgrimage to a place called Alvisopoli, which is in the Venetian countryside. And that was an estate my great-great-great-great-grandfather and his wife, Lucia, built at the end of the 18th century. It was a sort of model estate with the sort of more advanced agricultural technologies.
This fellow, your great-great-great-grandfather, was generations ahead of his time, wasn't he? He was a true pioneer and a progressive.
Absolutely, and completely at odds with the sort of old Venetian aristocracy, which was very conservative and literally on its last legs. Anyway, he was a luminary and a visionary, and he created this extraordinary place with, you know, wonderful housing for workers and pharmacies, hospitals, schools for the children, and sort of very advanced technologically speaking. And they had a son, and it was in Napoleon's time. And in those days, the sons of prominent families in the Kingdom of Italy, which was a puppet state created by Napoleon, were expected to go to Paris to receive an education in order to become sort of citizens of the empire, since they were bound to have duties in the future. And so this kid was packed off to Paris to his mother's desperation, the mother being this Lucia, my great-great-great-great-grandmother. And so she said, I will not allow this if I cannot go with him to Paris. And so she went to Paris to stay near her child. And the year was 1813, so just about a year before the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire. And in Venice, she becomes a close friend of Josephine. They knew each other from before. They'd met in Venice and then in Milan, but they become very close in Paris. And Lucia went to Malmaison every weekend, Malmaison being Josephine's house outside of Paris, where she had this extraordinary garden and this extraordinary collection of roses. Josephine was a real powerhouse in the world of roses. She was encouraging people to plant roses. She was very knowledgeable.
She was also extending their lifespan. One of the things that she did at Malmaison was breed roses, which had a longer tenure.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, she was trying to intercept all the roses coming from China and headed towards Great Britain. And she had special deals with the British Admiralty so that the ships would stop at some point in the channel and a little boat would go up and get whatever roses were meant to Josephine. Because at this time, there was the continental blockade. So Great Britain was isolated from the European continent. But they made an exception for Josephine's roses. Anyway, so Lucia becomes very close, and Josephine is the one who convinces Lucia to embark on this journey, on this botanical journey, and not just to become knowledgeable about roses, but to take advantage of the Jardin des Plantes, which was this extraordinary institution in Paris at the time, filled with luminaries, botanical experts, gardeners, or all sorts of wonderful people involved with plants and biology and so forth. And so she goes to the Jardin des Plantes, and she takes courses, she takes a diploma, she befriends all these very important people in the world of plants and roses. And when the empire collapses in 1814, there is really at that point no reason for her to keep her child in Paris in school. And so she eventually returns to this wonderful place called Alvisopoli in the Venetian countryside. And she brings with her from Paris 200 roses and endless amounts of seeds, different seeds, plants, trees, all sorts of things, in a special carriage that follows her on this long journey from Paris across the Alps and then through the Po Valley and eventually to Venice. And eventually, with all this material, she grows a wonderful garden in Alvisopoli, and she transforms the woodland around the property into a wonderful romantic park.
Well, before you came on the program, I was chatting to a distinguished scholar from Birmingham about Shakespeare, and of course that reminds one that he famously said, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. But this rose is called Rosa Mocenigo. Tell us who gave the rose that name, because this is the other character I want you to introduce.
Yeah, well, so Lucia planted all these roses, but then everything went eventually to seed over the centuries. The garden was destroyed, the park returned to wilderness, and the villa where they lived was turned into a low-income housing for the people in the 70s. And I went to this place eventually on a sort of pilgrimage to see what this place was like. And the caretaker of the place, when he learned that I was the descendant of Alvise and Lucia Mocenigo, said, I must bring you to see something. And so he took me, he opened the rusty gate and took me into the woods. And after a while, I realized he was trying to take me somewhere. It was just not just a regular walk in the woods. And finally, we come to a clearing. And there was this sort of secret garden of mysterious pink, silvery pink roses growing everywhere in the woods. And it was such a remarkable sight. I mean, I was no expert in roses. I'm hardly a gardener. And yet it was impossible not to be completely taken by this wonderful sight. And so he very generously gave me a plant, one of these roses, which I took eventually back to Venice to my house there, and I planted there, and now grows and produces flowers all year round. And he told me that the name of this rose was Rosa Mocenigo, simply by association with the family, with my ancestors who had lived there before. But in fact, nobody
knew. This is absolutely magical, isn't it, Andrea? This whole story is just enchanted.
Well, it was quite remarkable, yes, to stumble on it. And then the point was that they had no idea what this rose was, what the real name of the rose was, where it came from, and who had brought it there. And it was only later, by pure chance, while I was working on some other book in the archives of Venice, that I stumbled upon this old diary my great-great-great-grandmother had kept in Paris during her time there, during Napoleon's empire. And it was through that diary that I was able to reconstruct the story of the rose and why it had arrived there in the first place.
Links, things that connect. I have a lifelong admiration for Pasolini, the great Italian film director, and I remember he made The Passion according to St. Matthew, and which I think is the only truly impressive religious or Christian film I've ever seen, which was all the odder because, of course, he was a gay communist atheist, and he makes this remarkable religious film, and there's a connection with your rose.
Yes. Well, the connection is that eventually in this sort of wilderness, in these woods, there came a man, an architect, a local architect from that area, who was intrigued by this mysterious rose, and he kept making these pilgrimages to the rose. And eventually he started trying to find out in earnest what the story of this rose was. And he was a remarkable man. I met him several years later. I used to call him the rose planter because he didn't have a garden himself. And so what he did was he went around
surreptitiously planting roses.
Exactly. Now we are talking about old roses. He would never have done anything with modern roses. But
oh no,
he had
too
this,
vulgar.
Right. But old roses he was mad about. And since he didn't have a garden for himself, he would sort of, as you said, surreptitiously plant roses anywhere he could, in public parks, in old cemeteries, and around vineyards. He was also an architect, and so whenever he finished a job, he would find a suitable rose for the building he had erected, and would plant it either in the lawn nearby or against the wall, and he would always go out of his way to simply plant old roses wherever he could. And he was also fascinated by Pasolini, who had grown up in a little town nearby. And Pasolini's mother, Susanna, had a very beautiful old rose, a rose that didn't really have a name. It was called La Rosa di Susanna, Susanna's rose. And she was very proud of this rose. And then eventually Pasolini, as you mentioned, being a homosexual and a communist, was sent out of the town because he was accused of molesting young boys. And he had to leave the town he had grown up in and went to Rome. And Susanna, his mother, followed him to Rome. So many years later, the rose planter remembered that Susanna had this rose. And so he went to the old ruins of the Pasolini house and miraculously found that the rose was still growing there in the wilderness near the house. And so he took a cutting and then eventually planted it on Pasolini's tomb.
And of course, let the record show that Pasolini was murdered, brutally murdered by a young male prostitute in Ostia on the Roman seaside. So, I mean, that story is fantastic.
No, I too thought it was a very touching story.
You're listening to The Best of Ellinelle on Aaron Summer, and in this chat, I'm talking to Andrea de Robinant, author of Chasing the Rose. Tell us about Eleonora.
Ah, Eleonora, the Rose Lady. Well, you see, because then as I searched for the identity of this rose and for its origins and so on, I kept bumping into wonderful people who knew about old roses. And so one person would lead me to another, and one garden would lead me to another. We're not talking about big formal gardens. We're talking about local rustic gardens with wonderful roses that are of which the Veneto and the Venetian region is full. Anyway, it was the man I used to call the rose planter who introduced me to Eleonora Garlant. Eleonora Garlant is known all over that area as the Rose Lady, and she has an extraordinary garden up in northern Friuli. And I say extraordinary because it started out, she sort of developed this rose garden around the vegetable plots her husband made. And it is, I think, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen, this garden of old roses around these three vegetable plots. And it is this combination of rusticity, of sort of the countryside flavor, and extreme sophistication, because the roses she has, and she has very many, she has something like 1,500 types of old roses. So really an extraordinary collection.
And amongst this vast collection, there is our rose, because Paolo had given her a potted one.
Because the rose planter, exactly as you say, the rose planter, searching himself for the identity of this rose, had brought a potted Rosa Mocenigo to Eleonora Garlant, hoping that she would help him find the identity of this rose. But she had not been able to do so. And so when I came along with the story of my great-great-great-great-grandmother, everybody who had been involved with the Rosa Mocenigo was suddenly very excited about all this, about all these connections.
Now, something quite amazing was happening in her amazing garden, and that was seems to have been spontaneous hybridization, something that's always occurred in nature, but not all that common in our individual experience. And she had at least 60 new roses that you say can only ever be seen in her garden. But the assumption that these hybrids were a result of random pollination is not necessarily the case.
Well, yes. I mean, these roses are actually extraordinary. As you say, they're sort of natural hybrids that came to life in her garden, because her garden seems to produce a sort of special energy that brings flowers to couple and to produce new varieties of roses. And so by now, there are about, I'd say, 60 to 70 types of roses that can only be seen there because they were born in her garden. She has given names to them, and they can only be seen there because she doesn't give cuttings, and she's not in the business of selling her roses. But I went to see. I had assumed in my ignorance that they were the result of random pollination, as you said. But then I went to visit a remarkable man called Stefano Mancuso, whom I had known years before because I had written about the intelligence of plants and things of that nature. He's a remarkable biologist working at the University of Florence. And he told me that all of this is not a spontaneous type of phenomenon, but that actually nature comes together in a far more harmonious manner, and certain roses come together with other roses and attracts bees and other insects in a sort of in a way that is much more stage managed
It seems to be driven by the roses themselves. And you quote Darwin, who became fascinated by the way plants respond to external stimuli, using and exchanging information to adapt and survive. So you were witness to, well, an evolutionary miracle.
Well, I thought of it that way. I certainly thought of it that way. And also in this time of sort of diminishing species, in which we are constantly lamenting the fact that we're becoming a poorer globe. This idea of this wonderful little garden that simply produced more and more species, more and more varieties, as a kind of fountainhead of roses. I thought that idea very poetical and very warm and very lovely.
Well, nature itself can be cruel and of tooth and claw, but it can also have this sort of endless gift of benefaction and creativity.
Absolutely. Certainly you have an example of it there in her wonderful garden.
Now let me clarify something. We're talking about a woman who's still with us?
Absolutely. Eleonora gets up every morning at 5 o'clock with her lovely husband Valentino, and they're out there in their garden working all day long. They refuse to have any help, even though they're well into their 70s. And so you have to wonder what will happen to this wonderful garden once they're no longer able to spend so many hours out in the cold and in the heat.
Now, yeah. While we're in her garden, can you tell us what the dividing mark between old roses and modern roses is? Is there a year, for example?
Well, the thing is that originally the dividing mark was 1867, because that was the year of a special rose, which the French called rightly La France, was developed by a hybrid expert called Monsieur Guillot. But the Brits weren't very happy with that, with the idea that the that it would have to be a French divide. And so the date was eventually moved up to 1900. So the roses before 1900 are considered old roses, and the roses after 1900 are considered modern roses. But it's a very it's a divide that really is quite artificial and creates a lot of dissatisfaction. And so Eleonora's rule, she always told me, forget about the dates, just look carefully at the roses. You can't be wrong. Old roses have just this wonderful way of, this wonderful poise, this wonderful fragrance. They just look different, whereas modern roses always look as if they've been had a job done to them or something.
Well, all the people listening to you in Australia and elsewhere, Andrea, will now turn up their noses at modern roses and become devotees of the old. And being old myself, I'm wholeheartedly in sympathy with that. Tell me about the rose expert in Trieste.
I eventually contacted the American Rose Society in America because they have they handle all the matters of nomenclature and the certification and all these sort of bureaucratic things that are part of the world of roses. And I told them that I had not been able at that point to find the original name of the rose. And they suggested I go see someone who had been working a lot with them, a man in Trieste. But actually, I did contact the man in Trieste, and it was the man in Trieste who put me in touch with the woman who eventually helped me to solve the riddle of this plant.
Andrea de Robbeland eventually managed to get the rose registered with the American Rose Society, which serves as the international cultivar registration authority for the bloom. His book, Chasing the Rose, An Adventure in the Venetian Countryside, published by Annan and Unwin. I predict that on the very next LNL on RN Summer, we'll look at the ancient history of Delphi and the story behind Scott Fitzgerald's finest work, The Great Gatsby. Stay tuned on RN for the news. Talk soon.
ABC Radio app. It gives you access to RN on your phone, along with 19 other ABC radio networks, including local radio, news radio, Classic FM, Triple J, and all our digital-only stations. The ABC Radio app also has program schedules, links to our current ABC emergency coverage. It's free. Download it by searching ABC Radio app and take ABC Radio with you on your phone.